Always record 162. Okay.
I feel like that would just be kind of. I feel so disturbed about not having used that time a little better on my behalf. Anyway.
No, no, don't. I don't think so, Kiva. Don't worry. I mean,
that went by so fast. Oh my goodness.
The anxiety of squeezing this book into 42 minutes has been killing me for weeks, so I'm glad that it's over, but I totally agree. Like, there's so much to talk about. It's just like, ugh.
So we didn't talk, I mean, so the thing that I was thinking about is the 1984 Orwell illusion.
Yeah. Big Brother versus the little people.
Right, but then I was, you know, it seems like Big Brother translates a little easier than the little people to me.
Well, I was thinking of it in terms of like a sort of meta Big Brother, as in like Big Brother is now operating on this sort of like a cellular level, and it exits from a type of madness that afflicts people, like an inner voice gone unchecked. Or maybe that's where the lack of willpower of the character is, this sort of journey to find their willpower comes in.
For me, it was very much about the human experience and sort of more the Matrix. I thought the film The Matrix was a really nice companion piece to this novel. And there, you know, the idea of the moon altering, there's these notions of the wallpaper reality and the moon being a base, and it's kind of very Truman Show-esque. Only a paper moon, exactly. And so to me, it's like he's saying we're trapped. The Big Brother is really like just the human experience. I mean, we're trapped in bodies, we're trapped in cycles of birth and death, just like Talitha was talking about. And how
moon
do we
cycles.
Escape? Moon cycles. And so or like a Matrix, right? And only people. Yeah. So anyhow, it was more, I liked that concept of 1984 almost better than the externalized devil of like governments and power structures, where it's really something that's more inherent to the, what we're living in, what we've incarnated in, you know? So it's kind of a mystical a Big Brother or a spiritual Big Brother, you know, like a Gnostic, you know, I think it's a kind of a Gnostic idea. What are they called again? The, Archons, you know, sort of an archonic brotherhood. It's maybe more, or a Buddhist concept of like suffering is the first noble truth. There's no escaping that kind of Big Brother truth, you know?
Mm. So. Mm. Good. I like that. Yeah.
Something I had, Doug.
Tonight.
So the story begins with her in the cab and the Sinfonietta comes on. And they make a point of saying how the Sinfonietta was composed between the wars.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to bring that up earlier, yeah.
Yeah, and the story that I read, and I didn't realize that at the time, about the town of Katz was also composed between the wars. And so what is it between the wars that's so important?
Sorry, I think even more specifically what is important about this is it is between the world wars. Mm. And, I mean, and also, you know, when they're talking about this, the town of Katz and all that, and the train that, you know, and being irretrievably lost, I kind of feel like that has to do with like that space between worlds or that space between dimensions where, you know, many people talk about people getting trapped or consciousness getting trapped. Kind of like between different matrices, where there's nothingness, not even necessarily nothingness, but there isn't like a matrix holding it together. It's almost like the two opposing matrices or two opposing worlds. That area where they bump up against each other, and there's that space in between where they're, you know, that keeps them separated. It's maybe that, you know, space in between, and so I always have this like idea that the music or these certain things are like, you know, certain aspects of our indicators of either when there's going to be, you know, cause one of the things that's repeated in the cat thing too, it has to do with them going across the bridge. You know, why did he need to talk about them going across the bridge every day? you know, that they come in and out of the town. If you read that, it talks about them going across the bridge. So there's all these different,
well, and the,
you know,
train,
and trains, stop,
yeah, and the
and
train
a car,
not stopping was very similar to what SJ just said.
But these are all things about traveling, you know, a train, a taxi, a bridge. It's like going places, you know, and then.
And what you've said about airports and train stations.
Train stations, all that. Yeah, they're like, there's almost always major portals in those areas, I've found anyway. And the energy of people swirling and moving, it creates literally these big spirals of energy. That make it really easy to go in between places, because basically moving spirals in these different directions like unlocks these little things. So,
well,
anyway,
this book is like a big spiral. This book is like a big spiral. There's tons of things that are dragged into it that maybe don't. I mean, Kubrick is named a ton of times, and a couple of times even when it just doesn't even seem appropriate. Like there's like, so yeah, it's like a swirling of these forces that lead to a creation of that vorticular motion. So
what, when you were talking about the traveling, that's interesting, because one of the, and the thing about this book is it's big enough that they're like little vignettes that end up haunting you, like like you were there and then it's almost like you have this memory of being there. It's like, oh yeah, remember when he was talking about Chekhov going to this island and the Gilyak people and how they, right?
Yeah.
And so Tengo's reading Fukieri about, and so I didn't actually read the book. My experience was I listened to the book, and it, the actress who portrayed it did a wonderful job, especially.
Don't you think so? I know. I agree. Yeah.
I loved Ushikawa, and I loved the way the male voice did. The Tengo voice did Fukieri without her question marks. Her questions without question marks.
Well, the one thing about Between the Wars, just to say, you know, it's, I mean, even Japanese history, World War II is such a massive alteration of the Japanese timeline with the nuclear weapons. And I think that there's something to be said that, you know, maybe there was timeline alterations. There's all kinds of theories about what the bomb was, even in the sink world. You know, you have it's pre everything. It's like 1947. That's come up a lot this year with Bowie's death. I mean, Crowley's death, Bowie's birth, NSA, State of Israel, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. All seem to come after that 47 year. And so maybe there's the last moment of some kind of energy that was then eradicated. And certainly for Japan, I mean, going from a colonial power to basically being colonized effectively, I think that's a huge watershed moment. And also, isn't there in the book discussions of a nuclear bomb? Don't they talk about, allude to that at some point with Leader? I could be wrong about that. When he talks about John Lennon's death, it's not going to bring John Lennon back to life, or it's not going to... It's not going to prevent the leaders from destroying the world, something like that.
Was he I don't remember that part. I didn't brush up on that part, but I didn't remember.
It's a really subtle reference. It's not, it's not a big part of the book, but it's only in one quote that I think SJ.
I sort of grabbed onto that quote for some reason. That's one that stayed with me.
That's good. Also, did we talk about, you know, the playground bit? Did that come up in the conversation we had the other night?
No. Oh.
Or did it? It didn't come up earlier tonight either, did it? No.
Definitely not.
Yeah.
Okay. And that was what was interesting, because as you were talking about parallel lives, I definitely got a sense that Tengo and Aomami were in sync, but Ushikawa, when he's sitting on the slide, all of a sudden you realize that he ends up in sync with these characters also.
And he can like easily sort of tap into the outcomes of what's going on. Yeah. And that's maybe that's a skill he has, but also maybe because he has a connection that's broader than what. Yeah.
Yeah. I think
when Samara was killing him, it was really a tender scene because you could tell how much he respected him, and we cared for all these characters, and that he really didn't want to destroy this beautiful creature, but he had to because that was that was what had to be done.
Prime directive.
Sounds
so I'd say I, this coffee shop I go to, this girl there, she reads a lot. She saw me reading it, and then I came back a few weeks later, and she's like, yeah, I read that. And it was funny because I don't know her too well, but I saw her in the parking lot and we had this little short conversation and just some of the big things came out. And her favorite character was Ukashawa. Is that how you say that? And she was disturbed by the sexual, basically, you know, sexual abuse of children and how that was treated. So just to throw that in the mix here. And I think that is disturbing. I mean, at some level, there's a justification for sleeping with prepubescent girls. I mean, and it's not the novel. I mean, it ends on a high note. I mean, that was the means by which the star child is born and this loving couple gets to walk into the sunset. You know, it sort of kind of brushes that aside. And it is disturbing. I mean, thinking about it now, it is. I think that's a disturbing element of this book that needs to be somehow reckoned with.
It is disturbing, and it is part of what I think makes it feel so heavy, but not the only part of it, because her characters themselves seem to have a lot of heaviness. But
what's
I also,
so crazy about
at the same time, appreciate that it's sort of like out in your face, because it's kept so hidden, and I believe from my experience, you know, I have had a lot of experience with and working with people that have been in situations like this, and a whole group of people that I worked with for years that had this sort of horrific type of stuff going on. I mean, like being dislocated at their limbs and then sexually abused at a young age, but so they wouldn't run away, you know, so they wouldn't be able to fight it off. I mean, just really horrific things. But these things being so horrific and these people being so, I mean, so disjointed in themselves, in a sense, and yet whole beings with more experience than many people walking the planet. You know, reading this book really took me back to, I think it's one of the reasons it made me think about this as being one person and different ways to reconcile and different parallel sort of realities or different, you know, it's like, here's one aspect of like a cold, you know, kind of shut down assassin. And then there's this other like innocent male character that's just like along for the ride. And then there's this, you know, investigator who, you know, is in between. There's just, you know, I don't know, there's just so many different ways in which it can be one being trying to sort of reconcile really having been a part of or knowing about a lot of really intense stuff. And so while it's disturbing and it's like a really heavy, it's a heavy theme, but I appreciate that it's like out there and that it's talked about and that it's a big part of the book, because at least it's not being like skirted around and tiptoed around and okay, well, let's just only talk about it in a way that's like comfortable or, you know, no, let's freaking talk about it, you know?
Yeah.
So I kind of appreciate it at the same time. That was a long way to say all that. What were you going to say, Dennis?
I agree with you.
Yeah.
Well, like, how can it be reconciled if it's not put out there? Yeah. Absolutely.
And reconciling it, you know, it's fine to like go killing people or whatever, but that doesn't reconcile it at all.
Exactly. And that's why the Dowager is
what it does to another person's whole psyche, you know? That doesn't get reconciled without like, you know, and even if you kill someone, that doesn't put an end to the other people sharing that same consciousness level, you know?
And that's kind of my point, is that it treats it in a way where it makes it a fantasy. It's like the splitting that might have taken place with this traumatized person becomes this fantasy part of the plot. I mean, I agree with you, Talitha, wholeheartedly. Let's look at it. Let's see it. But I feel like how the narrative treated it, it just maybe could have made different choices to where it wasn't made a fantastical.
And yeah, sort I agree. Of maybe,
you know, so.
Totally, totally agree with that.
Well, the critics really, it seems like they didn't care for this one.
Yeah, I know. I just, before we got on, I just read some of that. I didn't know that. And
that makes me like it more.
But I think that in Japan, it was a wild bestseller. But in the United States, I don't think it was. What there was in the New York Times review, it was like 1,000 pages of boring. Or where did I find that?
Oh my God. I would like to meet that person. I'm so curious about that person.
1,000 uneventful pages. Stupefying.
Wow.
Stupefying, I agree with, in a way. But
this person said Kafka on the Shore was one of the best, 10 best novels in 2005. And I never read that one. It was always on my list. And so it would be interesting to have some context. Some of the things that I found irritating is, so there's this basic preoccupation with sex. Like the image of Tango that we have from the very beginning is this scene that's burned into his brain of this man sucking on his mother's breast while he's in the crib. So that I don't know. There's just, it seemed like the same way I'm irritated by some of Stephen King, where I think Stephen King's storytelling is so great, but then some of his language and thoughts seem really juvenile.
Yeah.
Yeah. The first scene, it's a lesbian memory of a lesbian encounter. I mean, not that the lesbian part is important, but just that there's this early sexual experience with her best friend that you open the book with. That I remember thinking, I mean, it was titillating, I mean, but it was like, yeah. it felt very lowbrow.
Titillating's the right word, yeah, because there's lots of little titillating scenes.
I don't even, I must have blocked that out, like I'm like, I don't even remember that part.
Well, and then so Aomami and her cop buddy, who's really a meter maid, they go on their sex capades, right?
Yeah.
And so it's really interesting how I found there's blending of like really real reality with like the heaviness that you're talking about, Talitha, and then also kind of like this almost comic book quality, like, oh yeah, this is just a story.
Buddy cop.
Yeah, you're right. Why don't they balance that enough? Because then it does make it seem just like completely unnecessary and annoying, you know, when you bring it up like that. I'm like, yeah, that is annoying.
So I definitely was irritated at times with this book. And I'm like, ugh. And I would turn it off. And then I would come back to it. But there were parts that I, like I said, because we were in that world for so long, you really feel like, you know, you spent some time and you made some memories there. You shared something with these people.
And, you know, when I was reading that book, it was really crazy synchronistic. And I was in love with someone who was reading that book, whom I met in a really strange way, who I had a very, like, deep relationship with that was much more deep, you know, when we were apart and connecting on these other levels, or when I was sleeping and would connect with him in my dreams, but in the you know, tangible dimension, when I would, you know, wake up or we would be together, I didn't feel those same things. They weren't there. And yet, you know, I mean, it was just a really intense time, and the ways in which we would both be all over the planet at the time that we were reading this, and how our lives would synchronize and things we would see from the book would synchronize. It was kind of like crazy and creepy, and it kind of was a little bit scary at was times.
When it first came out in 2011?
Yes. It might have been 2012. Yeah. But it was toward the beginning of when the book came out. It was fairly new. Yeah. And it was, you know, it was really intense. So the book also had this like other life to it, because it kind of melded into my life and then this other part of this other dimensional aspect of my life. So the book just felt so many folded that I would sometimes feel lost in it myself. But not always in an enjoyable way. But the fact that it seemed to have such a big life, I think, kind of made me like it, because I wasn't bored. I was like, there was always something to be thinking about or looking at, or something that was reminding me of it, or, you know, that sort of thing. So I felt like my mind was never bored. And I think that's what I liked about the book the most, maybe, is that it kind of, I never got bored and it never ended.
So I'm curious about, I think when you do an audiobook, it takes longer than if you read it.
But oh, what, does it? Uh-huh.
I think so. I think that you actually read quite a bit faster than if you were, I mean, it's a much different experience. But I'm curious, when you guys were actually physically reading the book, how long did it take?
I feel like it took me a couple of weeks. No, maybe even longer than a couple of weeks. I don't remember now, but I did. It was one of those things where like I didn't pick up any other books while I was reading this one, and at the time it came in like three sections. And I don't even think it had an audio tape because I probably would have listened to that over reading it, to be honest. But, yeah. And I remember at times, like I didn't want to put it down, but at times it was really difficult because I would have to reread parts of it because I would either have an emotional reaction to something that was going on in the book and that would sort of shut me down to some of the information that I would find that the next day when I opened the book back up, I couldn't remember the last thing that happened. I think because I got emotional about it or something. So I have to go back and read it. I remember being like, I went back and reread parts of this book more than I probably did any other book in terms of refreshing myself on the last couple pages I read kind of thing. So I feel like I read the book three times, you know, rather than just the once, but I went through it, you know, fairly quickly. I didn't lollygag.
Yeah, I blew through it. I mean, it was like a 40-page to 70-page clip a day. I liken it to binge watching a TV show, if you guys have done that. I'm sure everybody here has. I mean, we're in this.
Totally.
But I felt like I was just binge reading this thing. I mean, some days I couldn't read as much, but it just took me over, Doug. And I just probably put in a couple of, you know, some days like an hour, some on the weekends maybe, sometimes even an hour and a half or 2 hours, and I just kind of plowed. I banged it out, and like I said, the pages read very, very quickly. I'm sort of intimidated by the recognitions now because I'm, you know, it's written 60 years before. I'm hoping it's as easy, the prose or as flow as easily, you know. And certainly, I think like when I did The Man in the High Castle, I listened to the audiobook, then I read that after I heard you guys' show, I feel like the reading took longer than the audiobook on that for some reason. I just, for that book, I just was reading over and over again, like you're saying, Talitha. So I think it can vary, Doug, what's quicker and what's slower, depending on different factors.
But. How many times you read the last couple of pages? how fast did you go through it, Doug? You know, listening to it, like how long did it take you?
I think I've been listening to this for like 3 months.
Yeah.
And when I first brought this book up, you were also, weren't you also really not that excited about it? Like you had maybe started it before or you had thought about it and then you're like, no, forget that.
Yeah. I was really interested in it. And I was just now going back, trying to figure out when I, cause I remember it was around Christmas time some year. And I didn't get very far is the thing. It seemed like I thought I got far, but I wasn't that far into it when I just got tired of it for some reason.
And was even it though, easier listening to it than reading it than to get into it this
I
time?
Didn't even try to, I can't, I don't, it's easier for me to listen to stuff at this point in my life because there's always something menial I can do. But like, I look at that book and I'm like, how many? Yeah, I mean, I read just a few pages in the bath every now and again, and so my actual reading is not super voracious, but I listen to tons of stuff because usually I'm commuting or I'm in a freezer somewhere putting away freight.
He has kids, Talitha.
Yeah, I know. I can hear in the background. I think that's
walking dogs.
Yeah. I get it.
But I mean, so that was the experience. So instead of a binge, it was really slow for me. Where...
So was it brutal then?
No, I think I'm pleased that I did it and I enjoyed it. but I definitely was irritated a lot.
Yeah, I can tell when you talk about it. It's like, I can really tell. I'm so fascinated by that. Like, the different, you know, to have like one person be so irritated, you know, or maybe not so irritated, but, you know, irritated
well, so
enough, and then the other people just be like, I can't put it down.
SJ's reading is, well, because that element is there. There's the adventure, like the plot. It's like that you have to go from, so we enter this new world, and then they have to get out of the new world. Right? And so all the different little elements are exciting, and it's like an adventure movie, and so that's interesting. But then the SJ read of the love aspect is also fairly interesting. I lost my train of thought, what I was going to say. What I thought was, like, because it's so big, there's lots of different facets to say, oh, this is the importance of this work. But whatever it was that I thought was important is gone.
So what were some of the things you recall? Like, I know there's the sex stuff. Was there any other element that when you heard it, you sort of just kind of like, get me away from this for now, or that was hard to do?
I just became occasionally annoyed by Aomami. So, like, it's weird how I would prefer one character's story, but it wasn't exclusive. It would change. It's like, oh, I'm into this narrative right now. Oh, I don't want to listen to this narrative.
Yeah.
I thought it was interesting that we didn't pick up, you know, sorry, when you were talking about Aomami annoying you or whatever. It made me think about how we didn't discuss the hiding fact, the like paranoia or hiding out or.
Yeah.
It's all over the book. Like, every character does hiding at some point. Ushikawa, yeah. Puka Iri, Aomame, Tengo.
And if you had ever been in my practice in past years when people that had been, you know, sort of horrifically abused in these sort of situations, it would not be uncommon, you know, for them to hide aspects of themselves, memories from themselves, yeah. And have, you know, take a good long while to have stuff come up or to be working on someone and feel like you're working on this person. And then, you know, 6 hours later, because you got this person into something, then they like show up at your house on your doorstep, like, you know, an adult, but, you know, like an 11-year-old child on your doorstep crying. And, you know, there's just a lot of things in that book that I think were fascinating for me because I was looking at them from such a different perspective than maybe a lot of people reading the book. I think that's why my mind goes back to when I was thinking about all the hiding themes. It made me think about the different characters. And if I could go back and if I had the time and patience to reread, maybe I'll do it by listening to it. That makes more sense. Like, maybe if I go back and listen to it, I'll be able to find times where, like, if one's hiding, what are all the other characters doing at that time? And if it sort of shows any themes or anything with, like, who's hiding when and you know, which characters are hiding at different times. And
one thing that SJ pointed out in a previous conversation was that Puka Iri was 17 when she, at the time that she had that sort of etheric sex relationship with Tengo to sort of transport the seed of the child into Aomame. And so I think SJ pointed out the 17 star card connection, which I thought was a good catch.
Which happens to be the card I pulled today, by the way.
Yeah.
I sent that to Dennis this morning because I thought, how appropriate.
But so as you were mentioning the hiding, there's also the disappearing too, which is interesting. So I was thinking of Komatsu, how they actually nabbed him. And, you know, I think it was Sakigaki. They had him locked
up.
Yeah,
absolutely.
And then the mistress, she, well, we have no idea what happened to her. And her loss, actually, yeah. I mourned that. I felt really bad because I don't know if she's dead or if she's in an alternate universe or if the husband's just saying she's dead to you.
Yeah. I always found that to be a really big, like, another one of the unanswered questions.
Doug, one thing that I noticed today was that in the one scene where she goes back to the expressway and she, like, puts the gun in her mouth but ends up not killing herself, they say that she puts on green sunglasses, which I thought was a Wizard of Oz L. Frank Baum, where in the book Wizard of Oz, don't they all have to wear green glasses when they enter the Emerald City?
Hmm.
I think that's right.
Well, there is also that there's another green moon.
Yeah, exactly. Well, yeah, like, I don't know, I was tripping up for a long time thinking about the two moons in 1Q84 and the two suns in the Star Wars thing. So the sun-moon relation doubling. Yeah.
Mm. Well, and there, you know, people always, you know, attributing the moon to the feminine and there being a really heavy, like, female vibe in the book. And, you know, a lot of female, you know, characters and themes around the abuse of, you know, feminine type stuff.
Well, okay, so Eric Chrysalis is an expose on the inner workings of Sakigake, and at the same time, maybe 1Q84 is this sort of refocusing of attention to the moon, which, you know, SJ and I have discussed, like, what elements of the moon are they trying to make us think about? Like,
I kept having is that if there's this illusion that the book that's being written is the expose of what's really happening. And so I was curious about what we were getting into with the 1Q84, actually. Like, mm-hmm. What was it really spelling out for us?
Well, yeah, and the idea of the Shakespeare, I've talked a little bit about it. I was struck by the idea. I mean, Murakami's biography, he's this jazz owner and then, like, overnight goes into seclusion. And loses his, you know, has no social interaction, and then just becomes this novelist, this world-class novelist. You know, I'm not making any claims. I mean, it's just postulating here. But, you know, is he saying that this is how the industry works? You know, is he the author? You know, I mean, and I mean, there could be a whistleblowing happening.
Yeah, it's a fun thing to consider.
And we know editors are powerful.
So, like, how often does that happen in the art, or in the writing world, where the it's an amalgamation of, yeah, absolutely, like what you said about the potentially the Shakespeare story.
I remembered my air thread from before. So SJ's reading was about love, but I was seeing this in the negative space of the character's lack of. So, like, in Tango definitely did not. I mean, he was searching for his mother and all these ladies, these busty ladies that he enjoyed.
Older women, yeah.
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 Yeah, yeah.
Certainly.
And, I mean, that was, the irritation, because we were always being
told
about...
she gave her teeth to someone else.
The
yeah.
shape of her breasts and how big her breasts were and how awesome her breasts... These were the greatest breasts in the world, and then a lot of detail about pubic hair and...
Like, yeah. 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 A lot of pubic hair.
There was certainly some superfluous sexual stuff in there.
Yeah.
And then... With Eomami, it's interesting because I was, as we're having this conversation, I just edited the show from last week about emotional neglect and how that creates this emptiness in adults that they don't even know why they are empty, because it's like the negative space of their childhood. They didn't know. So they weren't, the woman who I talked to used the metaphor of gas. And so that's funny because in this instance, the put a tiger in your tank was like,
yeah, we talked a lot about that. Yeah.
Like, that was the little sign that she needed to see to know that she was both entering and exiting. So my reading, SJ, would be emotional neglect and what that caused in these characters and how they had to go back to their childhood to try and begin to fill their tanks again with something.
Yeah, I think that's, to me, it's awesome. I was on the most meta plot structure, I think, it's a love story, but certainly everything everybody's raised can fit in with that. And I think love, you know, there's this idea, how can you give love unless you've healed and are able to, you know, kind of cleanse yourself and able to receive, and certainly healing childhood trauma is a big part of that. And I think the idea of the age of 10, which is repeated over and over again, is a big part of when we're most impressionable. And, you know, I know those ages were difficult for me, so I certainly related to, you know, this kind of formative years and the traumas that are there and how we have to basically grapple with them the rest of our lives. But I think still, like, agapic love, and ideally this from not necessarily romanticized, but that can be part of the healing and part of the antidote, you know, that can ultimately lead us back to the real world. I'm just kidding. You know,
we're in for more of the same with the next book, though, with the missing mother, and it a lot of the same. So I'm started reading ahead in the next book, and it could be interesting.
What are we doing?
Did we decide?
We decided we're going to do the recognitions.
Okay, good. I'm psyched about that. I like that.
Well, it's another big one, though. It's giant.
I listened to a little interview. I don't know anything about the novel. I knew a little bit about him, but I've just been reading about him as a preparation. And apparently he lived with his mother.
Yeah.
So he didn't have a father and lived with his mother. So it's kind of an interesting inversion there.
At the beginning of the book, the mother dies. And so the son really doesn't have any relationship to the mother. And he relates to her through this unfinished painting that he won't finish because it's perfect. Because it's not finished.
How easy is it to read, Doug?
I'm listening to it.
Oh, okay.
It's fine. There are parts where it goes all wonky, where you're getting the thought of a lot of different people all at the same time, but they're little sections. And so if you just grit, bear down, you'll be able to make it through and pick up the narrative thread again. Gravity's Rainbow last summer, and it was rough because it just goes off, and all of a sudden you're like in everyone's consciousness all at once, and you have no idea where the narrative thread is.
Okay. Oh my goodness! By the way, Doug, I hung out with SJ in Austin for a day a couple weeks ago, and one of the things we did is we went to the Harry Ransom Center on the UT campus, and we went through the archive of the David Foster Wallace archive, as well as, you know, like Crowley writing, as well, original Crowley writing, and then also SJ went through some Yeats poems as well. But first of all, one of the books I looked at the annotations in David Foster Wallace's copy of Carrie, and then so it's funny that you brought up Stephen King earlier, but oh crap, I just lost what I was going to say based on what you were saying.
Losing
the narrative thread.
Gravity's Rainbow, losing the narrative.
Yes, I know. I was going to say, too, that we were discussing about the possibility of Murakami not being being an amalgamation of writers, but I also think Pynchon is a very obscure guy himself, and maybe he's blowing the whistle on the voice of the little people. Like, so this is, it is a chief influence for artists, and then, so maybe, like, it's more of a non-physical thing rather than like him being, I don't know, whatever.
The channeling. Well, the David Foster Wallace. Dennis, you've always told me that you read, or Alex, about David Foster Wallace channeling Infinite Jest.
Yeah, he said the same thing. He said the same thing, that he would just sort of tune into the voice and just write what he hears. And
Right.
Have any of you?
There was other things from that damn David Foster Wallace thing, but I don't remember what I was thinking.
Have any of you read Leaves? House of Leaves, I mean? Sorry.
No, but I've picked up another, I think the book that he did after that, which is similar in that it's a love story with two characters and you actually spin the book.
Yeah.
Like there's one character and you read her perception of the story.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah. Doug, I remembered, and your spin comment is appropriate, because in the notes of David Foster Wallace's The Pale King, he said he wanted the narrative to constantly be spinning like a tornado, and that the perspective of who's speaking is always completely chaotic, like you're in the center of a cyclone.
Who wrote Leaves? Sorry, I missed
House
that.
Of Leaves. Mark Danielewski. Danielewski.
It's sitting on my bookshelf for a long time.
I had started reading it a long time ago, and then like I don't know, I got distracted or something. But, Doug, did you start reading the Whale's Toe Letters or the Whale's Toe Letters? Is that the one?
Is that the newest one?
I don't know. I don't remember. Anyway, I was just wondering if anyone had read it, because it seemed...
I've never read that guy. At this point, I understand how authors are able to convey the way our consciousness interacts with each other now. You know, so like what you're talking about with this tornado is somehow conveying the internet and Facebook and how we're actually communicating and reaching each other. But at the same time, to actually read that as a literary structure is so much work.
Yeah.
Like even Infinite Jest, I thought. So
yeah.
I read on Infinite Jest for a year. I had like, and I did the end notes, and it was beautiful. I loved the experience, but holy moly, you could only do that in your 20s, I think.
Yeah. Unless you're paid to, like, a professor of literature or something like that.
Yeah. It's just, his end notes, so it was so meta, right? So you'd be reading, there was narrative in these, so like you had to have multiple bookmarks, and then all of a sudden, like, I would come home from work, and I would read for hours, and I would still just be reading this footnote here. You know, and I would lose. Yeah.
Yeah. That's not the reality for you anymore.
No.
No. Okay. Well, I was just curious if any of you had read that yet. I was thinking about that one.
So I don't know. I have it, but I've never really gotten into it.
There's another similar one where. You have to, so like part of that is the story is all over the place, and I think Dave Eggers' book, A Heartbreaking Work of Staggering Genius, had like text all over it everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
So like there were little quips in the
footnotes. And
in the copyright, there's like little winks and jokes and stuff.
Yeah.
Like these books that come in a box and you have to take pieces out and decide what the order you're going to read them in, and everyone's experience is slightly different. I think...
And that does sound like a lot of work.
J.J. Abrams has a book called S, which is you're reading different accounts and different perspectives, and I know House of Leaves is a little bit like that. If you look... Yeah.
I think it... I mean, it's described as, you know, being pretty much that way. That it's like arranged in a bunch of strange ways to like mirror the events in the story, but it has like multiple narrators who are interacting with each other in elaborate and disorienting ways. You know, that sums it up.
You know, Talitha, I was thinking a lot about your description of airports and train stations. My wife and I went and saw, God, it's a stupid movie. The new Star Trek movie. I thought it was
I saw that this weekend. Yeah, and I had two thumbs down with my reaction.
That was pretty dumb. Yeah, it's totally dumb.
Two thumbs.
But it really, it's portraying it's portraying exactly what you said. There's a city where it's a city that like almost looks like out of the movie Inception, where there's like it's a circular city in like there's trains going above you and like everything. Their gravity is not affecting people in a similar way in all of it. So like there's like cities above you and twirling around, and it was like exactly to your description. So. That was like one of the only enjoyable aspects of that movie.
I'll definitely not go see that.
Yeah, it was cheesy. I don't know. It was okay. Alex Fulton had some nice comments about it, but like,
Do you think they could make a film version of 1Q84? Or do you think do you guys know anything about that?
I don't know, but oh, boy, would I love to see the Cat Town.
Yeah, they cut out a lot. You could strip it down into some essential elements and then sort of build some kind of. It wouldn't be a total adaptation. I think it would have to be stripped down.
I think
maybe a mini series.
I think it could be even better as a film, maybe because they cut out some of that superfluous nonsense.
Yeah, that'd be good.
Actually, when I first started reading, I was reminded a little bit of David Lynch, because it seemed like there were things happening that I felt like, symbolically, this is important. I don't understand it, but I want to believe that it means something.
Yeah.
And so that was my experience with this book, is that I wanted to believe that there was meaning, but I wasn't certain if I understood what it was necessarily, or... If I wasn't able to, even if I grokked it, I wasn't able to articulate what it was.
Yeah. I just decided and projected onto it that it did have meaning, even when I wasn't understanding the meaning.
I will say, just like Talitha, I've had some like personal sinks around it in my personal life, Doug. And, you know, I felt some power in the text. It's kind of overflowed into some of my own experiences. And, you know, so from that perspective, I just kind of just give it the power that it's at least had on me or that's come. Like, for instance, I did some night swimming shortly after that text. I don't know if you saw the email Dennis sent with the night swimming, the REM reference about what if there were two moons. That's in the night swimming song.
Yeah, everywhere I was looking, I was seeing references that had the two moons in it. But that song has a very specific two moons reference.
So anyhow,
Dennis, you were talking a little bit about. I didn't get that at all. The leader and like maybe he was playing around with Crowley a little bit in the character.
Oh yeah. Okay. Well, here's why I felt like that was like the leader was referencing Crowley. First of all, we did say that there was that reference to the Beatles, which was sort of, and then you know Crowley's on the cover of it's not the same album. That song, All You Need Is Love, is from Magical Mystery Tour, but then the cover of where Crowley is Sgt. Pepper's, as SJ pointed out, but also he leader himself is talking about. He says, I have the quote somewhere, but he's talking. He's like, I didn't want to take morphine because I thought it would affect I didn't want to take morphine to dull the pain because it would affect my mental. Ability, which I thought was another Crowley reference to morphine thing, because didn't Crowley had a morphine addiction later in his life, right? Possibly other drugs.
Yeah, he did. Yes.
But anyways,
from what I understand,
but he's describing. He's also like going in to this narrative describing the King Kill ritual, which just felt like Crowley was speaking through leader there. It'd be also like whether it's whether it was like a viewpoint into why pedophilia would happen, and like because like I don't know if this is the same for other people, but like, part of me really just wants to know why, like, what is trying to be accomplished with this besides simply like sort of a vampiric energy transfer from a child, or why does it have to be pre puberty as something that Talitha and I have talked about as to why that would be, what changes from there on that makes this period beforehand the target of this. And so it's just shining a light on some of this structure that I was, and I know we already sort of fleshed this out, but that's, and so I wonder if Crowley was, I know he was, I don't think he was, I personally don't think that he was engaging it, but I think he was aware of it. I know he, so maybe this is a sort of, I don't know. I'm just spitballing a little bit, but.
Also, you know, the age of 10 is very well known in the esoteric world as being the age when the energy field is like fully developed. That's when the chakras have screens, the energy field has its full matrix. It's like connected to when the brain has like set itself and its belief structure, so that like by the age mm-hmm. of 10, the matrix is like, you know, complete and mostly, you know, based on the teachings of like your tribe, your family, your teachers, your culture, that sort of thing. And so, you know, there's a lot of interesting themes there too. And I know Crowley was very well known, not just for being really into astrology, and those cycles having to do with, you know, astrological stuff. But he was also, you know, really, really, really into like, you know, the psychology of people and their behaviors. Mm-hmm. And that was something he like wrote about so heavily in his astrological stuff. You know, you could hear in the stuff, the things that I've read of his, astrologically
yeah,
speaking,
yeah.
You can hear how in depth his knowledge is of like human behavior and human psyche. It's like kind of scary actually.
Yeah. The other thing, the big theme of the book I really wanted to get into, I wish we hadn't had more time, is just this idea of the nexus between cults, basically cults, and how cults have power.
Yes.
And
I know what you're, yeah.
And so, you know, Coley, the OTO is fairly powerful. I think there's a lot of money there. He's sort of a leader of that. I know it gained power after his death, but I mean, you know, the idea of cult leaders, I think there's some, at least somewhat attenuated link to Crowley as being the head of a organization with powers, you know, underlings mm-hmm. thinking he has powers. And there's certainly a sex magic element to the Crowleyism.
Well, yeah, SJ, you and I were talking about that. SJ, you and I were talking about that in Austin as we walked by the Scientology Center across from the Harry Ransom Center. So, yeah.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. Oh, boy. Yeah, man. I mean, I think Sagigake, Scientology, Sagigake. I mean, maybe they're, you know, like hearing the Japanese pronunciation of Scientology, it might sound like Sagigake with just some of the pronunciation quirks. But.
Well, I'm sure we could go on about all the little things that pop into our mind for a really long time.
Perceiver.
Oh yeah. I mean, and that's such like another one of those like masculine feminine things, like just in how like
yeah.
from the energy perspective, like the receiver and the receptive of the feminine and the active, you know, of the masculine, and even your right left sides and which eye puts energy out, which eye takes energy in. I mean, there's like so yeah, it's crazy.
The idea of little death too, you know, that's the name, a Japanese name for orgasm.
Or orgasm, French name, that's right.
You know, the idea that these beings they're paralyzed during the intercourse, both leader and tengo.
Yeah, the paralysis.
There's a death of a kind that's happening during the sex act. This book is very rich and thanks for recommending it, Talitha. I wanted to ask you, where did you hear about it? I mean, did someone say, read this book, and who was that person? Or did you read about it in the media? Or how did that come into your hands?
That guy that I was and all sorts of weird relationship dynamics with. He was thinking about reading it, and at the same time, another guy that he knew but wasn't really close to, that I was in a pseudo band with, was talking about it. And I just had this moment where I was like, it's not a coincidence that this is now, like, that I'm hearing about it in this particular way or whatever. There was something about it that I was like, that's too synchronistic. I'm going to have to read it. And so I ended up reading it at the same time as the guy that I was in that relationship with and another fellow. And we all read it at the same time. And then shortly thereafter, I gave my books to the other guy that had mentioned it, at the same time. And he read it very quickly shortly thereafter. And we all continued to have a lot of like synchronistic stuff, especially with the double moons and just all sorts of stuff where we would be texting each other. And you know, we were all sort of scattered around the world at different times and were keeping in touch with little things that were going on about it. It was very interesting. It was very sort of haunting, as I would be the best way I would describe how the book was, or how it seemed to be for me and the people that I read it with for the first time at the same time. It's haunting.
The other Crowley reference on the book I read on the spine, it was Q4 was the Q4, and that's 17-4, which is the Saudi is not the star, you know, the emperor and the star. So those were the two numbers right on the spine. And Crowley's big, I guess, advance in Tarot is that he switches the associations between the 4th and 17th trump and their Hebrew letters. We talked a little bit about this with David Plate in the members call. This came up, but that, I mean, I'm not sure that wasn't intentional, but it just seems like that there's a, certainly this book has some power to it. It's kind of a sigil in a way, I felt like, for me,
yeah.
It had power to it, in effect.
I feel like whether it was done on purpose or accidental, you know, it just feels like a lot of stuff was channeled into it. And I think that's why, even though it has heavy themes that I think can be triggering, I feel like the book, no matter who reads it, is like triggered with like a lot of stuff, you know, whether it's annoyance, you know, whatever it is, it's not a subtle.
It's funny that you use the word triggered, T, because the Recognitions book, what is this, Gaddis last name?
William Gaddis.
What is this? Yeah.
G-A-D-D-I.
Yeah. Doug, was that you that put out the Jonathan Frazen thing that references like the a systems theory type book? One of the first, ones. Okay. Yeah. Cause like Salinger, another book that has a sort of Salinger pinch on these books. I mean, they have like, even David Foster Wallace, these are very systems theory, influences.
He also, have you ever done Catch 22? Where there's a lot of characters and everything's just kind of happening simultaneously.
This
is something that I've thought about, like, how would you compose a sync novel? As silly as it was, Cloud Atlas is kind of telling these simultaneous stories.
Just going to say Cloud Atlas, though. Just going to say that.
Yeah.
That's James brought that up a number of times. Yeah. That's true.
Well, I wanted to say just quickly here, the scene in the book when I was reading 1Q84 where she starts reading the newspapers and she's trying, that felt like a sync thread. Like I could just see her as being like a sync, synchromystic or something, reading the newspaper saying, oh, that's this relationship to that, and kind of using media with the music and the news to kind of combine to formulate, I'm in this different world. It felt very much like a synchronicity practice. Eomame.
It's also it how like there spies was, communicate, which is interesting.
Well, there was a Philip K. Dick moment where when she's in the alternate reality, it seems like there's moon bases that they're talking about.
Yeah.
Yes. Russia and yeah, it was just like a dick moment in the sense that yeah, in with the book The Man in the High Castle, they're going to the moon, yeah. Colonizing. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and it's interesting because those three books definitely all play kind of nice together, and that was not intentional by any stretch.
Yeah, and it sounds like the recognitions might be right in line there with it as well. If there's a mother theme, that's a moon. There's the moon right away out of the gate, you know, the missing moon, you know.
But as far as what is real,
the other one went to 1Q84. That one, that missing moon. Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah. No, we're definitely in the trying to figure out what is real.
Yeah, and I love that about The Man in the High Castle. If I had to pick between the three, that's definitely I think the best work. And I would rank them, you know, 1Q84 second. And I mean, not that we have to do this.
Yeah, it's funny how, I was into Annihilation, but this book just blew it away. Like, it made it look like a child's novel.
Interesting, because I don't know. I mean, I think that The Man in the High Castle is definitely Dick's most accomplished work, but there's something really gritty and fun about Annihilation. But
yeah,
I think it's because
it.
it's a beginning, so it's all beginning, whereas we definitely did that whole series, and there were parts of the series that dragged.
That is the genius of Dick, and this is what's so genius about him. I mean, the great artist, there's a lot of talent, but the best can simplify and make it concise, like Mozart, a piano concerto, you know, the late concertos. And it sounds so simple. It's like, oh, a child can compose that melody. But I think Dick has a way of cutting things down into like 220 pages, but it's still jam-packed with all the same ideas. Yeah, you know, and that's a real skill set that, you know, makes it easier on a book club. Certainly.
With if we wanted to just go off of references, 1Q84 had so many literary references and Western references.
I know. Whoa.
And then the audiobook, did you continue listening? Because there's a half an hour interview at the end of mine with the translators.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Fascinating to think about. Yeah.
Yeah. There's some good stuff in there. So apparently Murakami is a really accomplished translator. Like, if he wasn't a writer, he would be famous for his translations.
He also wrote a memoir on running, which is, you know, my thing. So it's kind of fun. Doug, I ran a 42-mile run a couple weeks ago.
Wow.
Barefoot, right?
Yeah.
Where you're at? Someplace in
the
flatland?
Yeah, in Iowa. In the flatlands. But, continue. Oh, sorry.
I just want to say the translators for the third book that has to do Ushi
chapters
was one translator, and then there was translators plural for the first two books, but they were different. So it's a different translator for the third book than the first two. And I thought that was interesting because the third book has that whole different kind of breaks. The first two are together with culminating in that sex act ritual. And then the third it's kind of a whole different feel when it adds that. It feels more like a mystery or a crime novel. There's more elements of that.
Yeah.
With the audio recording, it's kind of a shock because I had no idea that third voice was going to come in.
I know.
And all of a sudden, it's
I felt the same
way. Who is this new character? But then it was so exciting. It's like, oh, something new.
Yeah.
I went back and looked. I had purchased this audio version in 2011, like December 27th, 2011. And it's crazy because I didn't think it was really that long ago. But I would have been listening to it early 2012, about the time that I gave up.
About the time that I was reading it, which I'm surprised
you know,
an audiobook that I was reading it because I would prefer to
listen to. Talitha,
Talitha, you know, one of the people I always saw reading this book was Jim Brown. Jim Brown was always carrying that book around, 1Q84. That's where I first saw it.
Yeah. I don't think he and I ever just...
He never finished it. He never finished it, I don't think, but he, yeah.
It's totally a Jim Brown kind of book, too. Interesting.
I know. He loves Asian women.
Yeah, he does.
The running back for the Cleveland Browns? Is
that... Yeah, same name. Same name, but no, he's in a band and he does performance work
pieces
in LA.
And always seems to run into Dennis and I only when Dennis and I are together, and it's like really random and like 3 years have passed or something.
Yeah, we saw him at the beach. We saw him at the beach last time. Yeah, that was weird.
Just like anywhere on the PCH. Just
hey, that guy! Right, that guy behind us looks exactly like Jim Brown, and it was Jim Brown.
He's like this. He's just like this weird guy that probably lives between dimensions, but he just like pops up at random moments. Anyway, not important really for the discussion.
Yeah.
But I imagine it's
he
getting
like does
late.
All these. Yeah. Sorry. It's not important to anybody, but go for it, Doug. Lay it out.
No, I was just worried about you guys because I know that you're all. Where are you at, Talitha?
I'm in California. It's earlier for me.
It's earlier. Yes.
Maybe you didn't get the last communication about that, where I had a blonde moment and I had it. I had the time differences, you know, backwards. I thought it was later for me. It's actually earlier for me than everyone else.
Yeah. Well, sometimes, like, with our member hangouts, they're just too early. Like, I don't want to start too late because I worry, oh, you know, we've got to be nice to other people. But 8 o'clock, when it's summertime, it's just so early. The kids are so
too early.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I know. There's too light out for, exactly. for summer member. Yeah. Hey, Doug, I have a question for you.
Yeah.
How often do you drop in and listen to AR? Do you tend to listen to Always Record, or how do you schedule your listening times?
My listening times have become a little. I used to listen religiously, but I haven't. I remember listening to the conversation that you guys had, but I don't.
Well,
think
I'm
I listened.
Well. The most recent one is really, really, really good. And I just wondered, it's really good.
The Gordon White one or the one that you guys?
No. The Gordon, well, I mean, I'm sure there's really good parts about ours too, but the Gordon White one is really extraordinary. It's such a high level of conversation.
Which part? Is it the initial
second
part? The second
part.
Because it seemed like Alan was telling me that they had some audio glitches and he didn't feel like he got the best stuff, which is
I think they had a time they were like screwed up on the time and but it's a really high level conversation. There was tons of he was such a great addition to the conversation. Like, clearly he's been doing his own it was really wonderful to hear somebody who can riff with Alan and David and a little bit of Bill on such a high level. Like, the conversation is really good. Because David can go and
I don't know.
I just wondered how often you pop over and listen to theirs or whatever. But I'm just.
I was really curious about that one because of the fact that it's all three of them back together.
Yeah.
I hadn't gotten there yet. I'm listening to the 1Q84 all the time.
I know.
Sorry, Doug.
Yeah.
No, but it's good because there's this sense of completion now because it was.
It's good because it's over. It's like a really intense massage.
And that intense massage, right? But she really, really worked him, and he didn't. Right? You know, it's like you could hear the bones grinding and all the popping and.
Yeah.
Well, he's moving clocks, you know, off the dresser.
Yeah.
I forgot about that.
Hey, Talitha, do you have any comment on that in terms of like, I mean, do you think he's what was your take on that? I mean, he's like, is he putting her in a trance in some way, or does he just have the power to levitate things, or what? I mean,
I don't remember that part right now. You'll have to remind me. Sorry, there's so much that I didn't catch up on. I didn't reread the book.
That was the big
time,
reversal.
So.
It was the big reversal in that we believe that he's such a horrible person, and then he says, oh, no, you know, they're not even real creatures. It's just shadow creatures. And look at, I can move a clock with my mind. Right? And so he's got to convince.
Yeah, he levitates the clock.
Yeah.
Which is, so the synchronicities I'm having that are silly is that I just finished watching Jake's Time God. Have you watched that?
Oh, yeah. Yes. Very good. It's unbelievable.
So now we've got all these clocks coming at me, and then you guys kept saying the age of 10. Yeah. And I kept hearing the age of 10. The age of 10, the age of 10.
Yeah. Interesting. Yeah.
Well, yeah, it's a big reversal.
I remember, I mean, I'm having a hard time remembering the levitating clock thing, but I do remember just the perspective change, because, you know, that was where my brain was talking about, you know, the projection from the Dowager versus then getting inside, getting closer to, and then having this other perspective where you're like, oh, dang it, you know, then, you know, now I have to change up my whole emotional makeup around this situation.
Exactly.
And like,
You
know, what am I going to do now? Hold, take a break. I need to get some popcorn.
But the necessity, it's an overlap, because while there's a perspective change, the end result is not deviating. So Leader wants to die. Dowager wants her to kill him. And that she kills him as planned. Like, it doesn't change what unfolds.
But it changes how we feel about it.
Exactly. Right. Yeah. Exactly. That's the whole. That's
so
the part
in that
of it.
Sense, it it's still this. Changes the end, because before we might have wanted it to happen, versus now not being sure if we want it to happen or if we feel okay with it. So it does change the end in a sense. But,
well, just in the sense that, I mean,
but not physically. You're right. Yeah.
You relate to it differently, but it makes us wonder. Well, why does this have to happen? Even though it's not so clear cut. What is happening and for what reason, yet it still has to happen. And I think it relates to the Star Child being embedded in the womb. Like, I think it doesn't go into why, how that happened, but I think it has to do with Leader dying, that maybe there was a new seed being born or something like that. And so it's almost like they all understood the necessity of the continuation required the death for these various reasons. And
it needed to be a big death if it was going to be a star child, right? I mean,
yeah, and like, what's the guy's name? Kamutsu? Is that, or no, the Tenuru? I don't have the pronunciations because
I don't have them either.
That's okay.
It's so nice to hear them say it properly, because they got to hear the translations properly. So I'm always like, I was not pronouncing that right.
Oh, you're talking about Tomorrow.
Tomorrow, yeah. So even once she tells them, listen. Yeah. You know, I killed him, but I mean, I don't think he's that bad. Everybody just, they don't like judge her. They're like, well, okay, great. You did what you were told. And it just sort of, things just move on, you know. and I thought it's by the end, the Dowager is so depleted by the end. You know, it's almost like she becomes a shell of herself, that her one-sided view of the reality kind of, she gets left behind in a way. It's like she wasn't, and so I think there was something
there. Kind of appropriate.
There.
For like age stuff too, you know, just in the way that, like, yeah, sorry, go ahead.
No, I'm just saying the flexibility, like, she was this old vibrant woman in spite of her age, was strong and life, and then by the end she just seems defeated by the circumstances, you know, almost like her view that these women needed to be rescued, and that woman vanishes and she loses some of herself. And I don't know, I just felt just what I said there, that it might be this idea that you have to have these flexible viewpoints of reality, that when we hold on to things in a fixed way, it kind of kills us, you know?
Yeah. But also holding on to stuff is what, like, keeps a person alive in a sense, because that was like her whole purpose, her whole life, that kept her here and kept her empowered to be here.
And then when the reality shifts, when not as many people hold to that same viewpoint or that same reality, it starts to crumble, and she's the only one holding it up. And then when she can't hold it up anymore, boom, it's time for her to go, you know, which is kind of how I perceive like age as well. Like, I mean,
don't just retire.
And like watching, and like what people go through when they retire and they lose that sense of identity. Yeah. But even watching, like, I have I have an uncle who's like 90 something years old. He builds parts for spaceships in Houston. His company builds these really important pieces that go on NASA spaceships. He's loaded. And he's like 90 something years old, still drives, like, it's crazy. He goes to the office every day, and it's like he's like this, like, really, you know, he has this really rigid belief system that, like, does not change, has not changed in maybe his entire life. And he has this purpose, and he has this business, and he is also sort of the head of his family, and it, like, holds him together, you know. Whereas
You should never send him any of those videos that are like basic, that, like, that guy Jaronism, who's saying that, like, all of the space flight stuff is just about it stealing money to build things that don't go anywhere, and that it's just a big money thing.
If I send that to him, he'll die.
Don't kill your uncle.
Is like the matrix that holds his body together, and when it's gone, yeah. Boom, you know. I don't know. I feel like that's true for a lot of, like, older people, that as, like, the new, you know, whatever you want to call it, evolutionary reality or whatever, the young people come in and they start pushing their reality in, and it starts pushing out the old reality. And before you know it, they're just killing old people all over the place because they want to have iPads. I'm kidding. That's a simplistic form, but it's funnier that way. So.
Yeah.
Like, every time you play with your iPad, you're putting your grandmother one day closer to death.
Your uncle's gonna run over somebody doing Pokemon Go when he drives to work.
I hope so. I'm just kidding. I have no judgment about Pokemon Go. I do. I'm lying.
I judge the activity, but I don't judge the person's value for partaking in it. You know,
exactly. Thank you. I'm just gonna borrow SJ's. You're so good.
SJ. Do you play that, Doug?
No, my kids are trying to, but not super effectively.
Don't they have to have a social security number and be a certain age now to get a Pokemon Go account?
I think my wife signed up for them.
I was just asking because this very day, earlier today, my friend's kid was like, "What's your social security number?" I was like, "What? Why? You're like 11 years old. Why are you asking me for my social security number? I'm definitely not giving."
Pokemon Go is going to totally implode the social security network by fake social security IDs for kids to... Oh, yeah. Okay.
Yeah, I was like, I'm not giving you my SS number for Pokemon Go. Sorry, buddy.
I'm worried I might be one of the old people that's going to get killed by Pokemon Go, you know, because I'm not adapting, you know?
Yeah. You're going to be dead real soon, then, if that's the case.
Old man Anderson.
We just need fads to blow through consciousness every now and again.
But can we have fads that don't involve people like doing stuff while they're driving?
It is amazing just about the phenomenon of it all. Like, in 1 week or something, I mean, it's outstripped, like, the number of people that have the Twitter app or these other apps downloaded on their phone. It's just like wildfire.
Really?
I didn't even know Pokemon was really still a thing.
It's nostalgic for the age of the people. Yeah. Really. So people that were young, maybe 10 years old in the 90s, how old would they be now?
They would be my age. So I was 10 years. I turned 10 in 91. So I'm 35, 36. Yeah. It'd be 35, 36, 37 in that age.
I could be just speculating wildly, but
I
had a similar impression when the big iPhone upgrade happened.
Five, the one that was the bigger.
Went from the way we were used to it to more of like a Smarties box or something. There was something. The look and feel really changed.
The size got bigger.
And I thought, all the icons changed, and it just felt like, oh yeah, we have the ability to really make big sweeping changes in consciousness right now with, something like that. Like, you upgrade, everyone changes their phones at the same time, and it's like, okay, we've entered 1Q84 at this point right now.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's tripped out, man.
Hey,
really,
what is the address of... You just mentioned it today, didn't you?
What is the what?
The address, the physical address of Apple.
Oh, of Apple. It's one infinite loop, Cupertino, California. That's their address, one infinite loop. And I was like, God, I'm like half jealous, half disturbed, half like I had
one
like,
infinite
like,
loop.
Yeah, one infinite loop. Yep. That's their address.
Of course. But now I worry that so Jobs was such a dictator and such a design. I mean, the only word for it is Nazi.
Yeah.
that with his death, it's all gonna just. There's no one that's gonna hold the tower up. That it'll collapse.
Well, I think it's been given over to other companies. So, I'm an Android person. I use their newest phones and all, and it's highly compatible. And Facebook, I think the baton has, in a way, been handed over to Facebook. So it's more about the software operators than the actual hardware makers. And it seems like Facebook has sort of taken that, but just in terms of, tapping into the technology that's really important to changing consciousness, I think Facebook is kind of leading the way, but...
I can't believe Google hasn't come out with their own phone.
They do. No, I'm using it. I've got the Nexus 5. They have the
That's
Google.
A Google thing?
Yeah, they have the Nexus program outsourced to other companies, but they're all through the Google phone store, and they're really good. No, I'm using this. Is the one that just came out last year, and they're cheaper. I use them because this is half price if I wanted to buy the iPhone, and it's just as compatible. I mean, I don't use Apple products. I got rid of them for the price. Just for the value, I couldn't afford it anymore to pay the premium.
Yeah, I hear you.
That's the
product, but I'm on Facebook, Reddit, these other third-party controlled, and then the Google search. I'm sure you guys, if you're using iPhones, use Google as your search, right? So
those and you use the Google Maps too, because the Apple Maps.
Interesting. Yeah, but
the Pokemon people, apparently there's you can generate crowds by just sending out a software change. I guess they put a Pokemon somewhere and then crowds of people will just descend. Are you seeing that in your communities? I haven't.
Well, Bill Klaus talks about, Bill Klaus
I just
said
to see
that
an
percentage
army of children descending upon some statue somewhere. So
Bill
sorry,
Klaus
you
said
can
that
tell.
That what's that, Doug?
Oh, I was going to say, so when you're out, so one of the things we've been doing this summer is my kids want to skateboard a little bit, and they just opened up a brand new world-class skate park, and so we go to the old one where nobody's at, right?
Brilliant.
But then you see all these kids wandering around in packs with their phones, and they're like, oh, those guys are hunting for Pokemon. You just see it.
Where do you live?
Yeah, I saw some yesterday.
I live in Boise, Idaho.
Okay. All right. I
we're on a dog walk, and you're walking up this trail, and there's a dude. No dog. He's looking for Pokemon.
Yeah, that's what this kid was doing, even in the house. I don't know if he was calibrating it or something, but he's walking around, and he was just he was so in another world. And I was trying to talk to him, and I was like, Jack, Jack, Jack. And he was just literally gone. It was he was in another world. And then when I finally got through,
they talk about
this Pokemon thing.
Weird. They talk a lot about this in the new Always Record episode about augmented reality.
There was a Brian Eno essay too about how we've lost our humanity. Like music is not even human anymore. I think this is the standard refrain, right? Every generation says this.
Well, I was listening to the Rolling Stones' Hot Rocks. I haven't heard of that in a number of years. I just put that on recently. I was just struck. I mean, this was a studio album, but it sounds like they're just jamming. I mean, and I haven't heard that in any of the recent music. I'm not that into it, but,
yeah,
you know, it was a really refreshing. It's like you can hear his voice and the timbre and the kind of little errors, and it I think there's something to it. I don't want to get on the bandwagon that somehow now is bad, or I think we got to stay open to the benefits of that we're getting. And, you know, I don't want to sound like an old man, but I do think that trying to retain some of that humanity, Doug, and put it into Facebook, if it's possible. I don't know. Maybe a Facebook Live. You know, you're allowed to.
Well, so like that was interesting when I was like, my thread this summer is all about like almost culminating in a weird way where maybe it was 2010, 2011. I was really trying to figure out how we can all live together. Like what would be the best society? Like what is a good community to live in? And so I was really trying a lot of different ideas on, and one of the ideas was, okay, so maybe agriculture was a bad thing. Maybe like returning to hunter gatherer, like, so like trying that on, like Daniel Quinn's book Ishmael, you know, like how far do we have to go back before we remove, you know, the splinter or whatever it is, the wound? How do we heal the wound? How far back do we have to go? And it's like, so I was talking to the anarchist, and you know, he, and then later I read this essay by Tom Wolfe about Noam Chomsky, where they find the tribe in the Amazon who's living without time, who's living in the present tense, who's, you know, it's like, okay, there's no way we can do that. This is, you know, where we are is where we are. The technology is not going away. We can't, you know, it's like, we just have to, I don't,
could,
like, there's no answer.
Could we have some major disaster that could wipe it out? And make,
but that's like, what the they're hoping for. And then you think of the Georgia Guidestones and, like, the ominous, right?
Well, I kind of have both. Sorry, go ahead, Dennis.
You know, it's a stupid aside. I was just going to say my daughter goes to Norman Borlaug Elementary. My oldest daughter goes to Norman Borlaug Elementary School. Norman Borlaug was considered the father of the Green Revolution and revolutionizing agricultural products with the idea that this sort of UN philosophy that we can feed the world. And he's like, I don't know. It seems more like the greatest. It's like looked at as this thing, and maybe it's not, and maybe it's like the worst enslavement method, mass-produced agricultural, I don't know.
Yeah.
Hard. Yeah. Well,
it's interesting, because I think in some weird, strange way, so like that was the thing that Zerzan was saying. He, you know, he wants to create face-to-face culture, and it's like, well, okay, that's authentic, that's real. But we live in a digital world where we communicate and we interact so much in a digital way. And I feel like it can steal our humanity, but in some strange way, the Sync Book has kind of created a face-to-face digital community where it is not a surface. It's not a surface community.
Well, meeting Dennis 3 weeks ago, or however long I said, I mean, I think it's a case in point. I was telling him, and I think I've communicated to him. I forgot if it was in person or later, but... Yeah, I mean, it felt like meeting an old friend, and we have had this whole relationship. And I met you, Doug, and it was the same with a lot of the guys at the Sync event. You know, there is a connection.
Yeah,
that.
Doug.
There's a depth there.
I would just, and to piggyback on what you're saying, SJ, I've said this a couple times, but it's so neat to, or I mean, you are exactly what I expected. You are exactly the person that I interact with. Like, and you know, yeah, it's just, I do think that this platform has done some of that. And...
So it is an authentic community, even though it's a virtual community.
Yes. Well, and maybe that's distinctions.
Yeah.
I think there's virtual elements, but I think the other way to look at it is that, is it virtual even at all? I mean, maybe it's real. There's some reality to it, that the virtual.
Well, and
you know,
Chalitha, in shared dreaming has occurred. Like, Chalitha, you were describing that earlier while reading 1Q84. SJ and I recently have had dreams where each of us were doing things. I mean, and so, like, and is that that reality just as real or I don't know.
I absolutely think that it is. Just because at this point I've had so many shared realities in the dream world that I just don't, I mean, I don't know that there's any, whether we're awake or asleep or whatever, I just don't know that there's any, I don't know that I believe that there is not, you know, constantly multiple realities and that any one of them has more significance than the other.
Facebook or face-to-face or Facebook, we're still some kind of reality.
And I mean, this might be the only, sorry.
Go ahead. No. That was my point.
I was just going to say this technology and people having like an addiction, supposedly, if that's what you want to label it, or an excitement or like, you know, something that makes them want to connect into it might be like, just one of the many ways in which people do link into their other, you know, levels of consciousness. You know, for a long time, I was telling people text messages I thought were great because I was watching it help people become more like tapped into their intuition, and they would know what the other person was like. They would start to read. It made them have to like connect more deeply, because if they didn't connect more deeply. Yeah. They might not understand the tone if they were just reading the text. So people would be reading the text and then they'd have to start thinking about, you know, and that's where it would start. They'd start thinking, well, what does this person mean by this? And pretty soon they would energetically be like reaching their energy streamers out further and further and further to link up to that person's consciousness to try and understand what they were saying. So I was watching it make all of these like psychic connections that people weren't making before. And I thought that was like a really cool thing, you know.
Fascinating.
And so it may just be that for our culture, we're not, you know, over in the Amazon doing whatever, but perhaps it's like how our culture gets linked into the Amazonian, you know, sort of way of being linked into everything else, because maybe it's the only way that we are going to grow into using these other things, which strangely is happening through these little screens in front of us. But like the reason why people are feeling like they're in another world is because they're literally connecting into like another dimension of the grid work or the mind network or whatever. So there's also that version of looking at it. Have any of you seen Embrace of the Serpent?
No, I haven't.
I haven't.
What is that?
It's a documentary that came out on my birthday this year. It's like all black and white. It's really beautiful just to watch. Like, you know, it's just stunning visually. But it is sort of a documentary / film that's based on a true story. And it has to do with like this tribe in the Amazon that only has one dude left in it. And I don't know. There's a lot of themes in it. I recommend it. You should just watch it.
I'm writing it down.
Embrace of the Serpent. But yeah, I totally think technology is strangely also a way to like link into these other levels of consciousness. I think it can go either way. I think it probably goes both ways at times.
Well, it also seems like there's an explosion of technologies that are not based on the new technology. I know that's a lot of the same word there, but I mean, you have like meditation, yoga, those things are thriving more than they may have ever been.
It's true.
So there's this simultaneous kind of augmentation that comes along with it, you know, and I find those practices to be highly necessary for me to stay sane in the screen world. You know, living in the screen world is to have time away from the screens with these physical grounding practices.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe kind of the universe has a way of self adjusting or self correcting. as we enter into this.
It's homeostasis, so to speak. Mm-hmm. It's equilibrium. Mm-hmm.
Doug, where are you at? I mean, I know I was earlier. I was thinking. Well, I was.
He's like wrangling children and eating a sandwich or something. What are you, where's Doug?
I was just thinking when we
started. I'm here.
When we started the call, like, you know, you had done this wizardry and Talitha had said, Doug, that must have been hard. Then I was thinking, well, Doug's probably done this 500 times or more, you know, trying to work with Scotty. <Yeah. laughs> So anyhow, you know, the technology, I mean, the sync book and all that is totally utilized. It's created from that technology. And that's a big part of what you've done and your whole experience, you know. So
just me learning that there was such a thing as the sync book. I remember when Dennis first like sent me a link or something to it, and this is going to sound really cheesy and girly, but I was like, I like cried because I was like, wow, you know, I know it's also cheesy, but like, I don't know how many years prior to Dennis, I mean, well before I even knew Dennis, when I was in my, you know, early 20s, you know, synchronicity in general, especially around numbers, was such a big theme in my life. And it was something that I had so many conversations with myself about. But at that time, that was, you know, the late 90s. And it was not something that I could talk to other people about. Even in my healing school program, which was mostly people that were quite a bit older than me. So I was like 19, 20, 21. And I mean, this was something that was such a big theme in my life that, you know, I felt like the universe was speaking to me through numbers and some symbols as well, but mostly numbers. And it was like I couldn't escape it. It was just there all the time. It was such a big part of my life, but it was this whole reality for me that I never got to share with anyone, you know. And then, you know, time passed and it became less a thing in my world. It wasn't as loud and other things became loud for whatever reason. But for me, it felt like a whole other world that was trying to speak to me, you know, that was engaging me and that I was engaged with. But that was like a non-human sort of consciousness, this, you know, numbers thing. So when Dennis, you know, shared with me sync or whatever, I remember crying. Just, it was almost like it like gave me this little minute or however long it was of like a healing, like, oh, that exists. And now that part of me that was like so lonely or so distraught about it was like totally okay, you know, and without the internet,
absolutely,
like, you know, that never would have happened, you know, and strange as it was, it was just knowing that it existed was like, somehow like made everything from that time period for me totally okay. And I didn't have to like go any further than just knowing that this existed. You don't get that, you know, it's like so many people, I feel like, you know, with the internet and with technology, they get to find like an extended, they get to find that extended group of beings or that consciousness that even if they don't interact with those people or that group of things, whatever, all of the time, it's like they know that it's there and now they feel a link, a connectedness, which I think creates some sort of connectedness back in themselves, you know, where there was some, you know, where we, what do you call it, compartmentalize ourselves or whatever. So it's almost like, you know, inwardly and outwardly similar things happening. So I think it has a lot of healing aspects to it. All this technology.
Absolutely.
All right. Should we call it?
Yeah.
Sounds good. Yeah. Thank you. You guys. Well, that was a lot of fun.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks.
Do you wanna try the next one, Talitha?
You said it's a really super long one. How long are you guys going to take to do it, do you think?
It'll be November, I think, when we'll do the show.
Oh, I could totally make that happen. Yeah, I could make that happen.
There is an audiobook, so, T. It's an audiobook.
Awesome. All right. Yeah,
it's longer, though. So I think the last one was 46 hours and 50 minutes. And this one is it's like 47 hours.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, it's similar. It's,
let's see how we all do these next couple of months with, like, the crazy, like, weather stuff and, like, all the crazy war and Turkey, because that shit's going to... Sorry, excuse my language. I think that stuff's... all that stuff's going to really amp up in August and September. September especially. But, I think I can... I feel confident that I can make that happen.
Yeah, 48 hours...
Less than an hour a day.
And then World I may War have already away, picked... I like to have an idea of where we're going. But I think in the spring, we have to do Ulysses.
Whoa.
I would love
Zenor, to. And Zenor wants to join us for that one.
Oh, no, that would be great. See, I've been waiting for us to steal away one of these big guys. Because, like... I mean, reading 1Q84, there were so many parts where I was like, I wish David Blaite is reading this book so he can offer his precise opinion about what this is. Zenor would be amazing. Yeah.
And I think Alex is going to join us on the recognition show, too. So that'll be fun.
Alex Fulton?
Yep.
Oh, awesome.
Wonderful.
That's great.
Wonderful.
All right, well, you guys have a good night.
Thanks for having me, guys. I appreciate it. It's so nice.
Yep.
Well, thanks for picking the book. It was fun.
My pleasure. I'll leave the book picking up to you guys. All right. Good night, everybody.
All right. Good night. Peace.
Bye-bye. Later, everybody. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
Night swimming deserves a quiet night. The photograph on the dashboard taken years ago, turned around backwards so the windshield shows. Every street light reveals a picture in reverse. Still it's so much clearer. I forgot my shirt at the water's edge. The moon is low tonight. Night swimming deserves a quiet night. I'm not sure all these people understand. It's not like years ago. Fear of getting caught. The recklessness of water. They cannot see me naked. They go away, replaced by every day. Night swimming, remembering that night. September's coming soon. I'm pining for the moon. And what if there were two, side by side in orbit, round the fairest sun? That bright tide forever drum could not describe night swimming. You I thought I knew you. You I cannot judge. You I thought you. underneath my breath. Night swimming. Every street light a reminder, night swimming deserves a quiet night, deserves a quiet night.